welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 9th of May 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, the summer is now finally here, but as always, we are indoors recording this podcast for you out there, and today we will be discussing the week's news pertaining to Britain and also our greatest Britons, and we have joining us today Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. What's life like where you are? It's a beautiful summer's day over here. What's it like where you are?
Oh, it's beautiful summery weather here as well. I can't complain about the weather. It's absolutely lovely, and I think that the English countryside is looking as beautiful as ever. Sorry about that. It's my phone just making a funny noise. The British weather is very sunny, and I'm looking forward to a very enjoyable summer.
It has. It's suddenly heated up. All of a sudden, the summer is actually here, and you no longer have to wear your coat outside, and everything's green and really bright with colour. It is really beautiful, Britain, in the summertime. And of course, we have also had some elections, local elections, which have really caused quite an upset. It seems that the Tories have lost lots of their seats, and Labour Party have gained quite a few seats, not as many as they were hoping. And the biggest surprise of all, or maybe not such a surprise, because I think some people were expecting it, is that Sinn Féin have won the majority in Northern Ireland, which could mean that there might be a referendum on Northern Ireland joining Ireland within the next 5 years. I think that's probably the most shocking part of this, the part of it that's going to cause the most change is Sinn Féin winning this majority. I don't know if they've got an outright majority. It does mean that the Sinn Féin leader, the vice president of Sinn Féin, will be the person leading the government there at Stormont, but I'm not sure if any of these other parties are actually going to work with them so that they have a majority. So, I mean, we don't quite know what the situation is going to be over there just yet. But that is really the most surprising thing in all of this. And I think it's come about basically by Catholic birth rates. I mean, the Protestants have all fallen for feminism, and the Catholics are still producing lots and lots of children. And over time, they've produced enough children and enough people there to vote for Sinn Féin. So we could be seeing some changes over there in Northern Ireland. And they're saying that Boris Johnson might be the Prime Minister that oversees the breakup of the UK as the result of Brexit. So lots to get into there, Max. You're quite up on these elections. You've taken part in a lot of campaigning for them in the past. What are your views on the local elections?
Well, I don't think the local elections produced as big a shock to Boris as might have been the case, and as lots of people were hoping for. I think that the message that there are bigger things to worry about than whether somebody had a birthday cake in their office has sort of occurred to quite a large number of people, and people are more concerned about more important issues. Such as the war in Ukraine and our involvement in that, such as the worsening economic situation, and also the situation in Northern Ireland, I think, is an aspect of these local elections which is perhaps focusing people's attention far more than local issues that normally preoccupy the discussions around local elections. That's not to say that those local issues aren't important. It's just that I don't think are seen as being as important necessarily as some people might have hoped. I think that the situation in Northern Ireland is one where the in that Sinn Féin have got a majority. It means that the First Minister of Northern Ireland will be a Sinn Féin, will be the leader of Sinn Féin, whose name escapes me temporarily. But the Geoffrey Donaldson, who is the leader of the DUP, which is the largest unionist political party under the constitution for Northern Ireland, will be appointed the deputy leader of the government. or deputy prime minister, or whatever the position is called. And from an interview that I heard over the last couple of days, where he was being interviewed on the radio, he kind of indicated that if this situation resulted from the local elections, that it would probably result in the DUP not supporting the devolved parliament in Northern Ireland, and so we'll enter one of these very protracted periods of negotiation and wrangling over internal Northern Irish political issues, and the Stormont Parliament will, to some extent, be a little bit of a lame duck parliament until that situation is resolved.
Yeah, I think it's Michelle O'Neill is set to be the leader, or the first minister. That's what they call it, isn't it? Of the devolved, yes, power sharing parliament there. But one thing that really gets me is they refer to Sinn Féin as the nationalists, and they're really not nationalists. They're internationalists, and they support abortion. I mean, they're supposed to represent Catholics, yet they support abortion. They support internationalism. They support Marxism. They support the EU. And then you've got the BBC referring to the Scottish National Party as the nationalists. And again, they're internationalists. So they want to join the EU. They don't do anything for the nation of the Scottish people. They're all about internationalism. And then you've got them talking about Plaid Cymru in Wales. They refer to them as nationalists. And, you know, it just really gets me. It really does get to me. And then they refer to Azov Battalion, or Russia refers to Azov Battalion as the nationalists, and they're working hard to put down ethnic separatism, you know, which is genuine nationalism. It just seems nobody seems to actually understand what this term nationalism means anymore. And the people that are using it are using it in a fraudulent way. And it's being made as if it means something completely different to what it actually does mean. I mean, a nation is a group of people that are united through their ancestry, through their birth. That's what the word natio means. It means birth. It means people that shared birth, not the country that you're born in. I mean, that could be any country in the world. It doesn't change who your parents were and who your grandparents were and who your grandparents' grandparents were. That's what the nation is. And a nationalist party should really be doing its best for the people that it's chosen to represent. And I don't think Sinn Féin represent the indigenous Irish people. They represent anybody that comes to Ireland. They want to open it up and have mass immigration. So they don't really represent the Irish, and the DUP don't really seem to be that much better, although they were against abortion, and they are sort of nominally patriotic. They are very patriotic, but they're sort of nominally nationalist. They also support Oliver Cromwell, who was responsible for the banking, the Bank of England, basically, and the system that we have with the Bank of England, which has led to the massive inflation that we have today, and the huge debt that we have with interest, and that can all be traced back to Oliver Cromwell getting rid of the king, bringing in his financial backers from Holland, and then bringing in their king from Holland, which was King Billy again, who the Protestants in Northern Ireland think is a wonderful fellow, and he basically turned over the Bank of England to these financiers and made it into a private bank, so that they could create the money and set the interest rates and basically make all the money from it. And we've ended up with a system that, instead of giving value to all the wealth that we've created, all the wealth that we've created is noted down as a debt. So we can't ever possibly pay back this debt. And yet, in actual fact, what we have and what we've created in the world gives it immense value. The only thing that actually gives value to something is mankind himself. And yet we've got this ledger which says that everything that we've created is in actual fact debt, and it's all owned to these banks, and it all goes back to Oliver Cromwell and King Billy. But and that's sort of like a broad way of looking at it. I know that I mean, you're quite a numbers man, Max. I'm not, and you understand the inflation rates and unemployment and how the economy works. But you were saying, you know, we could be in for another recession, and things really aren't looking too good on that front with inflation and all the rest of it. Do you want to explain some of that to us?
Well, before we do that, I think that one thing to follow on from is what you were saying about Sinn Féin not really being a proper nationalist organisation. The Sinn Féin have used Irish nationalism, or Irish patriotism, I would say, have used Irish patriotism in order to help galvanise a lot of support amongst the Irish population for a dismemberment of the UK. And in my view, Sinn Féin's primary objective is to bring about the partial dismemberment of the United Kingdom. It's already achieved 50% of that aim by the creation of the Irish Free State. And it looks as if they will attempt to complete the job by having a referendum which will eventually separate Northern Ireland from the rest of the United Kingdom. And the negotiations for Brexit were carried out in such a way that it was obvious from the terms that were being negotiated that there would be a problem surrounding Northern Ireland, where the European Union would insist that they have to support the Good Friday Agreement, and they have to make sure, even though the Good Friday Agreement was nothing really to do with them, they have to ensure that the Good Friday Agreement is intact. And we've had Biden from the United States coming in saying, oh, he won't support the British government in anything if we go against the Good Friday Agreement. And in order to avoid going against the Good Friday Agreement, we've had to agree to this situation of there being a border down the Irish Sea separating Northern Ireland from the rest of the United Kingdom, which the government have several times now claimed, you know, isn't the case. Oh, no, that's not what we're doing here. And they claim that the people that negotiated the deal didn't understand that the interpretation given to the treaty withdrawing from the European Union would actually mean that Northern Ireland would be dealt with separately from the rest of the United Kingdom. And it was absolutely obvious that it would create a serious problem. It was absolutely obvious that as far as the unionist parties in Northern Ireland were concerned, they wouldn't accept a situation that separated them from the rest of the United Kingdom. Now we're in a situation where where Sinn Féin have achieved a majority in the Stormont elections, which is going to, as I said earlier on, create a situation where Northern Ireland will appear to be ungovernable. And so we've got a situation where Northern Ireland will appear to be ungovernable, where the largest political party is going to be Sinn Féin, where Sinn Féin will organise the election, the referendum, and where a lot of people in Northern Ireland will have reached a point of absolute despair of anything ever being sorted out. And I think that there's a very high likelihood. It's not something I would like to see, but I think there's a very high likelihood that the referendum will be for what would the referendum result will be for Northern Ireland to separate and to be ceded to ERA. It's fairly obvious that this whole situation has been contrived so that the problems with Northern Ireland over trade have been exacerbated and have been ignored. And this has all been in preparation in order to demoralise the loyalist community within Northern Ireland so that they become apathetic and therefore don't vote. And that then has created the situation where Sinn Féin has got in there. So I think that's a very unfortunate result, because, as you say, Sinn Féin isn't a nationalist organisation. It's an organisation that's been motivated by left-wing and woke ideology. And just as left-wing and woke ideology is intended to create an atomization of the society that previously existed and the united society that existed prior to the advent of Marxism. So we have a situation where Sinn Féin is aimed at creating this dismemberment. And as I said before, they've used Irish patriotism in order to galvanised support in amongst the Irish population from people who don't really understand the difference between somebody who says they're a nationalist and somebody who actually is. I mean, the name Sinn Féin actually means we ourselves in Irish, but it's not the Sinn Féin isn't going to be governing Ireland for the Irish people. Sinn Féin is going to continue with support for the globalist agenda that both the government of Southern Ireland has and which the European Union has, and that will continue to sell the Irish people down the river.
It's 100% globalist, aren't they? 100% globalist. I mean, that's the thing. If they were actually for the Irish people, then I wouldn't really have a problem with it. You know, we want to have governments that are representative of the people that the party is made up from, but they're not. That's just it. They're not going to do what's best for the indigenous Irish people. They're going to do what's best for the globalists, and they want to open the country up. They just want to separate it from Britain. I mean, if it was a genuine nationalist organisation, and they were saying we want to be separated from the United Kingdom, well, okay, you've got a separate ethnicity there. You want to govern yourself, and a homogenous community is obviously the best way to be governed. That's what nationalism is. So I wouldn't have a problem with it. As it is, they're an internationalist group that want to separate from the rest of us. And you've also got this other group there, which is like the Northern Irish, who are loyal to the United Kingdom. So, you know, you've got problems there because it's just not genuine nationalism. And I think they've really sort of tried to solve this problem by saying, well, we'll just have this Northern Ireland bit that's going to be attached to the United Kingdom, and that'll be the mainly Protestant bit. But now that the Protestants have stopped breeding, then you know the Catholics have got more. And it's just a matter of numbers, isn't it? They were when I went over there a while back, and I went on a black cab taxi tour, and of all the areas of the Troubles, and seeing the murals, and he was explaining all this, and he was saying this is the most important election in 100 years. Because we are expecting the Catholics to actually win this election, and it is down to the fact that the Protestants have all stopped breeding; they've all fallen for feminism. So you've got traditionalist-minded people, but they voted for a party which is internationalist, which is not going to do the best for the Irish people. It's very sad. As I say, if they were actually for the Irish people, the Indigenous Irish, then I would say, well, yeah, you should have a referendum and govern yourselves. But that's not what they're going to do. They're going to do the same as the Scottish National Party and Plaid Cymru. And I just hate the way that the word nationalism has been abused and twisted to mean things that are the complete opposite of it, and to give it a bad name, you know, like the bad name that it has in Ukraine. I've gone a little bit off topic there, Max. If you want to address that or talk about inflation and the rising living costs, it's up to you.
Well, just going on to that, the sort of economic situation, we're drifting into a worsening of our economic situation. We have benefited for some considerable time from very low interest rates, and this has tended to lull people into a full sense of security, and it's fairly evident that the Conservative government, the current Conservative government, have started to spend money almost like there's no tomorrow. You know, and it's not so long ago. I can't think which Conservative politician it was. I know that it was repeated by several other Conservative politicians, but the phrase that there is no magic money tree. Well, it seems that, you know, whilst the previous Conservative governments couldn't actually find the magic money tree, it seems that the current Conservative administration have actually discovered it, or think they have, and they've started borrowing money like there's no tomorrow. And I mentioned this in some of the articles that I've written in the early part of 2020, where I wrote about the fact that the way in which the government were dealing with the pandemic was such that it was going to cause a massive amount of borrowing. And here we are 2 years later in a situation where the national debt is now £2.223 billion, which is an absolutely massive amount. It equates to £40,000 for every man, woman and child in the United Kingdom. Which is a massive amount. If you consider it per family and you assume that there's a mother, father and 1.4 children or whatever the usual average is these days, you know, that's working out at something like £120,000 per family, effectively, which is an astronomical amount of money. It's like everybody in the country having a second mortgage. And it's a second mortgage, but instead of us making the repayments individually to whoever the money's being borrowed from, it's the government making those repayments on our behalf. And so, what are the consequences of having this massive amount of debt? Well, it's affecting interest rates. And so we've had a situation now where the Bank of England have recently put interest rates up to 1%. But that's the Bank of England base rate. That's not the rate that you have to pay if you want to borrow money. If you want to spend money on your credit card, you'll still have to spend something like you'll still have interest at something like 30% per annum on there, which is absolutely astronomical. You will, but if you borrow the money on a mortgage where it's secured on a house, you'll get a much more reasonable rate than that, because the mortgage rates now are around about 4%. Which is a significant increase on the situation a year ago, but still not historically massively high. But the point is that rate going up is now causing people's mortgage repayments to go up, and at the same time, people have been lulled by the very low interest rates into borrowing larger and larger amounts of money. If we look at the situation with regard to house prices are rising by roughly 10% per annum. They did over the last 12 months or so, which means that the average house is now £288,000. And if you compare that with the average income across the UK, it's something like 12 times the average UK income. And if we assume that somebody would need to have a 20% deposit, it means that people are still going to have to be, you know, couples will still be borrowing something like six times their joint income in order to buy a house. And that is a colossal debt burden. It's a colossal debt burden that you can carry when interest rates are very low, but when interest rates start going up, which means then that your repayments are going to be going up quite markedly. What we're going to find probably in the next year or two is that there are going to be a lot of people who are going to run into real financial problems, and a lot of people who are going to end up having their mortgages foreclosed upon and losing their homes. A repeat of the situation that happened in the late 1980s when the property market collapsed. I think that kind of a scenario could possibly happen again, which is very, very unfortunate. And the
can I just stop you there, Max? Do you mean that, like, the property market might collapse and then houses would then become cheaper again, which I think is what they need to do, because, you know, it's like a bubble, isn't it? They expand, and it needs to burst so that people can afford to buy them again. Obviously, people who have already bought houses would lose out if they couldn't pay the mortgage, but would that then mean that property prices return back to more reasonable costs? If you're saying, you know, if there was going to be a big crash, am I right in thinking that?
That's the possibility, but the other thing you see that which is driving house prices up is immigration, mass immigration, and the fact that if the government aren't going to do anything about mass immigration, which they don't appear to be inclined to do, then the greater demand caused by immigrants coming into the country is going to some extent outweigh the loss of demand as a result of our people not being able to afford their mortgage repayments. And so it's difficult to see quite what effect it's going to have on house prices, but it will have a distinct effect on people's ability to be able to afford their mortgages. And that's the problem. If we have a look at the amounts that are being borrowed, in the year between 2019 to 2020, government borrowing increased by just under £57 billion. In 2020 to 2021, which is the year in which the pandemic was most severe and when we had all the people working from home and the with furlough being paid for them and all this sort of thing, government spending or government borrowing that year went up to £321 billion. And so from 56 up to 321, that's like a six-fold increase. So during 2020 to 2021, we borrowed six times as much as we normally would have done in any normal year previously. Now, in 2021 to 2022 so far, we've only increased our borrowing by £138 billion, but that's the financial year so far. That was the financial year from March 2021 through to the end of January 2022. So we've still got another couple of months to add on to that. So that's likely to end up at something like about £160 billion. So the borrowing at the moment isn't as the new borrowing isn't as great as the new borrowing was in 2020 to 2021, but it is still at a much higher level, over double the level of borrowing that we would normally expect prior to the pandemic. And as I said, that's pushed the national debt up to $2,223 billion, so that's at a record high. And the other thing which is a cause of additional expenditure for us now is the support that we're giving to the Ukraine. And before I looked at a few figures earlier on today, I had sort of suspected that the government might have gone completely full tonto, to use Boris Johnson's term, with regard to borrowing to make donations to the Ukraine. It appears, though, they've actually been a bit more measured than they might have done. Total government pledges to the Ukraine so far, from what I can make out, are around about $220 million, so not even in the billions yet. Although it was announced in December 2021 that that our government had entered into an export finance deal worth $3.5 billion in support of the Ukrainian economy. Liz Truss has also announced in February 2022 a further $500 million in loans to the Ukraine. And again, in February 2022, there's been a £100 billion three-year package announced from our government to provide assistance to help wean Ukraine away from Russian gas. But large like as those figures are, they are absolutely dwarfed by the spending that the government incurred paying for people to sit at home on furlough during the actual pandemic. And that is going to be their undoing at the end of the day. And the figures that have come out have shown that as far as Sweden is concerned, which is the country that was very reluctant to have a lockdown, was reluctant to pay furlough for people and tried to keep life as normal as possible, and who were savagely attacked by politicians throughout the rest of Europe for sticking to that policy. It turns out that the number of deaths that they have sustained as a result of the pandemic are actually quite modest compared with lots of other European countries, and certainly by comparison with Britain. And so it appears that our government's policy with regard to the pandemic was mistaken, and Sweden are much better off than us. They've still suffered proportionately a similar number of deaths. So there's nothing really for Sweden to be particularly pleased about from that perspective. But from the perspective of the increase in government debt, I think they have got a lot to smile about, because they haven't been lumbered with massive extra debt in the way that we have here in the UK. And at the moment, we've seen inflation rising to 7%, which is the highest that it's been since 1992. We've got unemployment rising to 4%, and it'll probably rise higher than that because there'll be some cutbacks in public spending. You know, that the public will not have so much money to spend if they've got much higher mortgage rates to pay. And as you sort of intimated perhaps a bit earlier on, this could all have been financed in a different way as well, which is the other great sad thing about it. You know, we do have this fractional reserve banking system where when the government borrows money, or when the government needs more money to spend and money that they haven't got, that they borrow it into existence, borrowing the money from the banks. And that then means that when inflation does occur as a result of government spending large amounts of money, it means that not only do we have very large repayments that we have to make to banks, but it also means that the way that the government reduce the amount of reduce the inflationary effect of all of their borrowing is to raise interest rates, which means that money is taken out of people's pockets because they're paying higher levels of interest for the loans that they have. But that the interest means that there's more money flooding into the coffers of the banks. And so the banks benefit from high inflation and high interest rates, whereas we as a nation don't, because we because by borrowing the money, we are further in debt, and it's inflationary, and it causes the economy to stall because higher interest rates means people have got less money to spend, which means that the economy starts to take a dip. It would be so much better if instead of borrowing money into existence, our governments just printed their money, because we would still have the same amount of money coming into the economy, but it would be printed money instead of borrowed money. And in that it's printed money, that would then mean that we wouldn't have increased debt, and and when it came to taking anti-inflationary measures, it would just simply be a matter of the government withdrawing money from the economy as money's collected in as taxes. A certain proportion of that money could just be siphoned off and incinerated. And that would then mean that the money supply would be reduced, but it would be reduced in a way which wouldn't be painful to people. And the reason why we don't do that is simply because of the influence of banks on government policy, and banks fight tooth and nail for the perpetuation of the of our current banking system, the fractional reserve banking system, which enables them to create money out of nothing and then lend it to the government.
Yeah, lend it at interest. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, how much does it cost to print this money? Well, according to them, it you know, there's this 1% interest rate, 33% on the credit cards, and all of that is really unnecessary, because all you're really doing is monetizing somebody's promise. Somebody promises that they're going to pay back a certain amount of money. They're going to work to pay that back, so that promise is then monetized, and that is put into circulation. But then you've got to pay back interest on it, and there isn't enough money in circulation to pay back that interest, because it's only the promise that's been monetized. So how do you get the money into circulation in order to pay back the interest? Somebody else has to take out another loan. So that's how you end up with this massive debt mountain, because in order to pay back the first loan, a second loan has to be taken out. And I mean, this I think is in the past why we always had like something that was called a Jubilee year, and all the debts went back to zero after 40 years or 50 years. They used to do that in the Bible. They used to do that over here in Britain as well. Alfred the Great wrote it into his Book of Laws. And it's a very sensible idea. You just zero everything after 40 years or 50 years. Everything goes back to how it was. And it prevents you getting into the situation that we're in now, where we have this debt which is just completely unserviceable. And I mean, on top of that, as you say, Max, they've taken out all these all this borrowing for the pandemic, and then on top of that, now we have all these payments to Ukraine, war payments, and then we're saying, well, we're not going to get our oil and gas from the cheapest place anymore. We're going to get it from the most expensive. They're talking about going to Africa to get their oil now, instead of just going to the, you know, to Russia, which is next door, which is offering it cheaper than anywhere else. So yeah, there could be some very hard times coming ahead, especially with an inflation rate of 7%. I mean, that's quite incredible. And houses going up by 10% a year, that's 1% a month almost. Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah, it's shocking stuff. Well, should we go back in time and talk about our greatest Britons then?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's talk about Elizabeth I again. And last episode, we had a look at Elizabeth's reaction to a small number of black slaves that had appeared in Britain. From her writings, it became clear that the status of these slaves was higher than that of unemployed white people who were perishing for the want of employment. Elizabeth arranged to have all of them taken to Spain and gave the tender for this to a good man who had rescued native Brits from the enemy Spaniards. We also heard about the Elizabethan Age of Exploration and the settling of America, which took place at the same time as the founding of the East India Trade Company, which led to Britain controlling half the world's trade. And I really did find the bit about the black slaves most interesting, because it did, because they complain about it and they say, oh, these black people that were here in Britain, they were slaves. And yet, if you look at the writings, she's saying, well, the white people are perishing for the want of employment. And these black slaves actually had a higher status than the white peasants. And the white peasants would have given their right arms to have been employed as slaves, because if you were a slave, you were looked after. You had your keep paid for, you had your clothes paid for, you had a roof over your head, and you were taking part and you were being productive. And there were English men that were unable to do that. And this was in a time of great poverty as well. I mean, there were famines in Ireland, but there were also famines in Britain at this time. And there were these people here that weren't a part of the British nation. And she was very clear that they were not a part of the extended family that make up the English nation. And they were also not Christian. And she made the distinction that Christian charity should be given to Christians rather than Christian charity being siphoned off and given to members of another religion. So I guess these black slaves must have been Muslims. We talked a little bit about America and how England was very important to the settling of America. And of course, that's why they speak English, and this East India Trade Company, which pretty much led to the British Empire and the rights and wrongs of it. At least Britain had a huge empire. The sun never set on the British Empire. And that all started at this time as well. Do you have any thoughts on that, Max? Anything you want to add to that?
No, I don't think so. Not at this point.
Well, let's start talking about her image here. As Elizabeth aged, her image gradually changed. She was portrayed as Belle Phoebe or Astrea, and after the Armada as Gloriana, the eternally youthful fairy queen of Edmund Spenser's poem. Elizabeth gave Edmund Spenser a pension. As this was unusual for her, it indicates that she very much liked his work. And I think he also talked about Brutus of Troy. I mean, at this time, it was the history of the kings of England that was known as being the history of Britain. And there was a lot of patriotism and a lot of pride in actually being British, and pride in our Trojan heritage. This Fairy Queen was supposedly a very important work. I haven't actually read it, but this is really the one that sort of gave her this mystical aura and made her out to be a fairy queen. Her painted portraits became less realistic and more a set of enigmatic icons that made her look much younger than she was. In fact, her skin had been scarred by smallpox in 1562, leaving her half bald and dependent on wigs and cosmetics. But I mean, everybody wore wigs back then, didn't they? I mean, it's still a hangover from then, is the judges and all the people in the court are still wearing wigs. Her love of sweets and fear of dentists contributed to severe tooth decay and loss to such an extent that foreign ambassadors had a hard time understanding her speech. So it does seem as if she physically wasn't doing too well at this time. Yet they refused to reflect that in the pictures that were drawn of her, and she came out with more of a mystical aura. Max, were you trying to say something there?
I was just thinking, how old was she at this particular point in time? 1562, how old would that have made her?
I haven't got the exact date of her birth here, but I would have thought around about 60.
Yeah. I think the thing to bear in mind there is, you know, despite the fact of her physical deterioration as a result of age, I think the average life expectancy would have only been something like about 50 in those days. And so, you know, people tended to age faster because life was harder. There wasn't the same sort of medications and health service available in those days, even if you are, you know, were a king or a queen. She probably would have been a much older woman physically than the average 60-year-old woman would have been today. And so, you know, we need to take that into account and shouldn't necessarily, you know, people shouldn't make judgments about her based upon current rates of aging.
Well, she was actually born in 1533, and I think what we're talking about here is sort of about 1580. So she must have been about 50 here, around about this time. Now, André Hérault de Massé, the ambassador extraordinary from Henry IV of France, reported an audience with the Queen, during which he noticed her teeth are very yellow and unequal, and on the left side less than on the right. Many of them are missing, so that one cannot understand her easily when she speaks quickly. Yet he added, her figure is fair and tall and graceful in whatever she does. So far as may be, she keeps her dignity, yet humbly and graciously withal. And Sir Walter Raleigh called her a lady whom time had surprised. And I guess we take it for granted that we have dentists today that can sort our teeth out. I mean, you imagine what having toothache was like back then when we didn't have anaesthetic and you'd have to pull your tooth out with pliers. I mean, it's shocking. We actually, back in Egyptian times, they used to be able to make bridges and put gold wire across people's teeth and put teeth in. I've seen evidence of that. But I know in Britain, we certainly didn't have anaesthetics at this time. And that sort of thing I do wonder about. And parasites as well, you know, worms and things like that. I mean, it must have been pretty horrible to get ill at this time. This was before... before we really had the medical industry that we have today.
And there wouldn't have been local anaesthetics. It would have been a matter of putting somebody under with all the risks involved of them suffering heart failure whilst they were unconscious and things of that sort. And so going to the dentist and having a tooth out, for example, would be regarded as a much more major operation than it would be today.
Yeah, I think, did they have ether back then? I think all that stuff that they used to put on a cloth and somebody would breathe
that in. But with a 50-year-old woman who probably would have been the same kind of physical condition as perhaps a 60 or 70-year-old woman would be today, being put under using even some sort of spirit of that sort, it would still create a very heightened risk of them suffering heart failure whilst they were under the influence.
Yeah, heightened risk for the person carrying out the operation as well, if that happened, I should imagine. And the period produced an unsurpassed literary flowering in England. The first signs of this new literary movement appeared at the end of the second decade of Elizabeth's reign, with John Lilly's Euphues and Edmund Spenser's The Shepherd's Calendar in 1578. During the 1590s, some of the great names of English literature entered their maturity, including William Shakespeare and Christopher Marlowe. Continuing into the Jacobean era, the English theatre would reach its peak. The notion of a great Elizabethan era depends largely on the builders, dramatists, poets and musicians who were active during Elizabeth's reign, but they owed little directly to the Queen, who was never a major patron of the arts. But at least she didn't go down the Puritan route. She didn't like the Puritans, and it was the Puritans that were putting a stop to all of this. They didn't want to have artwork and dancing and music and all the rest of it. And she refused to go along with the Puritans. As we talked about in earlier episodes, she was a Protestant, but she was also quite mild towards the Catholics. But she was certainly no Puritan. And it says here that she was never a major patron of the arts, but I think she did have something to do with it, perhaps with the musicians. And William Shakespeare, I mean, he's the most famous playwright of all time, and this was at this time. It was a very exciting time to actually be in England, I think, when you think about it, all these things happening and going over to America as well, discovering that.
One of the things before we go past it, you were saying about how she styled herself in various ways and was in particular the eternally youthful fairy queen of Edmund Spenser's poem. And it just struck me there that Gloriana, nowadays that the sort of modern version of Gloriana would be Gloria, and in sort of you miss the fact that Gloria as Gloriana is effectively a sort of a female name version of Glorious, and so it is actually a very nice name and a very attractive name, particularly I think as Gloriana. And people tend not to name their children using such glorious names as they may have done in the past.
Well, they used to name them after famous kings and queens as well. I think Victoria, wasn't she named after Boudica? Boadicea? Queen Victoria?
I don't know. That's,
yeah, I think I think
I've never been aware of.
Yeah, Victoria means the same thing as Boudica or Boadicea. And I know a lot of the kings that were named in the history of the kings of England, people would name them after them. And there's still Welsh people that are named after the early Britons, but not so many now as there was back then. People tend to name their children after people in Hollywood movies now, which is a great shame. The more Elizabeth's beauty faded, the more her courtiers praised it, and she was happy to play the part. But it is possible that in the last decade of her life, she began to believe her own performance. She became fond and indulgent of the charming but petulant young Robert Devereux, the Earl of Essex, who was Leicester's stepson, and he took liberties with her, for which she forgave him. She repeatedly appointed him to military posts, despite his growing record of irresponsibility. After Essex's desertion of his command in Ireland in 1599, Elizabeth had him placed under house arrest, and the following year deprived him of his monopolies. In February 1601, the Earl tried to raise a rebellion in London. He intended to seize the Queen, but few rallied to his support, and he was beheaded on the 25th of February. Elizabeth knew that her own misjudgments were partly to blame for this turn of events, and an observer wrote in 1602, "Her delight is to sit in the dark, and sometimes with shedding tears to bewail Essex." So perhaps she was actually in love with this Robert Devereux, the Earl of Essex, but he certainly failed in Ireland. And this was the sad thing. She did fail in Ireland. She posted quite a few people she actually posted to Ireland, and they all failed to solve the problems there. Famine was the main one, because we've gone into this before, that because it was the last place to go to. They would go to Scotland, they would go to Wales, and then they would go to the continent, and then finally they would pay some attention to Ireland. And by that time, you couldn't tax the British people anymore to pay for the army, and the army would start deserting, and the Irish would fight back against them, and there was no money left to invest in the place. So Ireland really has had a bad rap, I think, from England, from being part of Great Britain, which it was at this time. The Queen's health remained fair until the autumn of 1602, when a series of deaths among her friends plunged her into a severe depression. In February 1603, the death of Catherine Carey, the Countess of Nottingham, the niece of her cousin and close friend Lady Knollys, came as a particular blow. In March, Elizabeth fell sick and remained in a settled and unremovable melancholy, and sat motionless on a cushion for hours on end. When Robert Cecil told her that she must go to bed, she snapped, "Must is not a word to use to princes, little man." So she did sort of refer to herself as in the male form quite a lot, really. When she was sort of leading, she would say she was leading as a king, but even though she was a woman. And here she was referring to herself as a prince, even though she was a queen. And that we had this tradition of not allowing a queen. At least the Saxons did. They wouldn't actually allow queens. I think allowing us to have a queen came in with the Normans. She died on the 24th of March 1603 at Richmond Palace between 2 and 3 in the morning, and a few hours later, Cecil and the council set their plans in motion and proclaimed James the King of England. And I think it was, yeah, that was the King James who then ended up getting a Protestant Bible written, a proper Bible, which again has like stood the test of time and is a great literary masterpiece. I mean, you talk about like William Shakespeare at this time, and you've also got the King James Bible that was produced at this time. England was like right at the top with literature. While it has become normative to record the death of the Queen as occurring in 1603, following English calendar reform in the 1750s, at the time, England observed New Year's Day on the 25th of March, commonly known as Lady Day. Thus, Elizabeth died on the last day of the year 1602 in the old calendar. The modern convention is to use the old calendar for the date and month while using the new one for the year. That's interesting. I wasn't aware that we used to have New Year's Day on the 25th of March. That ties in with the equinox there, doesn't it? So we used to have the spring equinox as the new year.
And with the financial year as well, really.
Oh, is that where the financial year comes in, is it?
Well, no, the financial year begins on the 6th of April, so it's only like 10 days later.
Just a week away. So it must have all been tied in together originally. Elizabeth's coffin was carried downriver at night to Whitehall on a barge lit with torches. At her funeral on the 28th of April, the coffin was taken to Westminster Abbey on a hearse drawn by four horses hung with black velvet. In the words of the chronicler John Stowe, Westminster was surcharged with multitudes of all sorts of people in their streets, houses, windows, leads and gutters that came out to see the obsequy. And when they beheld her statue lying upon the coffin, there was such a general sighing, groaning and weeping as the like hath not been seen or known in the memory of man. I mean, that must have been very somber on a barge lit with torches going downriver and then having this big funeral afterwards. Elizabeth was interred in Westminster Abbey in a tomb shared with her half-sister, Mary I. The Latin inscription on their tomb said Regno consortes and Erna hic obdor minus Elizabetha at Maria sororis inspi resurrectionis, which translates to consorts in realm and tomb. Here we sleep, Elizabeth and Mary, sisters in hope of resurrection. I think Mary was the queen before Elizabeth, and the queen that didn't have any issue, not the Mary that was the Queen of Scots that was riling up all the Catholics against her. Right. Well, Elizabeth was lamented by many of her subjects, but others were relieved at her death. Expectations of King James started high, but then declined, and by the 1620s, there was a nostalgic revival of the cult of Elizabeth. She was praised as a heroine of the Protestant cause and the ruler of a golden age, while James was depicted as a Catholic sympathiser presiding over a corrupt court. The triumphalist image that Elizabeth had cultivated towards the end of her reign against a backdrop of factionalism and military and economic difficulties was taken at face value and her reputation inflated. Godfrey Goodman, the Bishop of Gloucester, recalled, "When we had experience of a Scottish government, the Queen did seem to revive. Then was her memory much magnified. Elizabeth's reign became idealised as a time when Crown, Church and Parliament had worked in constitutional balance." So they didn't really realise just how good they had it until afterwards, basically, which is always the case. The picture of Elizabeth, painted by her Protestant admirers of the early 17th century, has proved lasting and influential. Her memory was also revived during the Napoleonic Wars, when the nation again found itself on the brink of invasion. In the Victorian era, the Elizabethan legend was adapted to the imperial ideology of the day, and in the mid-20th century, Elizabeth was a romantic symbol of the national resistance to foreign threat. Historians of that period, such as J. E. Neill, 1934, and A. L. Rowles, 1950, interpreted Elizabeth's reign as a golden age of progress. Neill and Rowles also idealised the Queen personally. She always did everything right. Her most unpleasant traits were ignored or explained as signs of stress. So as the years went on, people thought even highly of her. and of what she had to put up with. And when you think about her whole life, going from seeing her mother beheaded and all these intrigues and being imprisoned herself, and you know, there was a time when she herself could have been beheaded, and yet she made it to becoming a queen and really capturing the nation's hearts, and doing so for quite some time, I think. Yes. Born 1533, died 1603. So for 70 years. And I'm not quite sure how long of that she was reigning for. Must have been at least 45. Recent historians, however, have taken a more complicated view of Elizabeth. Her reign is famous for the defeat of the Armada and for successful raids against the Spanish, such as those on Cadiz in 1587 and 1596. But some historians point to military failures on land and at sea. In Ireland, Elizabeth's forces ultimately prevailed, but their tactics stain her record. Rather than as a brave defender of the Protestant nations against Spain and the Habsburgs, she is more often regarded as being cautious in her foreign policies. She offered very limited aid to foreign Protestants and failed to provide her commanders with the funds to make a difference abroad. Well, she didn't have the funds. That was the problem there.
It wasn't her job to spend the nation's money on the nation. Yeah. Rather than on other nations.
Yeah, on foreign policies. I mean, that was a good thing. She didn't go abroad making wars and taxing the British public loads of money to go and have a war over some argument that she'd had with some other king, which is what so many of the monarchs used to do. She established an English church that helped shape a national identity and remains in place today. But those who praised her later as a Protestant heroine overlooked her refusal to drop all practices of Catholic origin from the Church of England. Well, I think that was good. I think she was trying to appease both factions. So that's why she continued to keep some of the practices that were of Catholic origin. She wasn't trying to, you know, cut off all the Catholics. She was trying to bring them into the nation again and to rule one nation rather than a divided nation. She wanted them to be united. So that's why she kept some of these practices. Historians note that in her day, strict Protestants regarded the Acts of Settlement and Uniformity of 1559 as a compromise. In fact, Elizabeth believed that faith was personal and did not wish, as Francis Bacon put it, to make windows into men's hearts and secret thoughts. She didn't think it was right for her to tell people what they should believe. Though Elizabeth followed a largely defensive foreign policy, her reign raised England's status abroad. She is only a woman, only mistress of half an island, marvelled Pope Sixtus V, and yet she makes herself feared by Spain, by France, by the Empire, by all. And that is praise, because that was her enemy, basically, the Catholic Pope. And he tried to foment rebellion against her. He said anybody that supported her was going to be excommunicated. And he really did try to cause her trouble. So to say that is that is praise indeed. Under Elizabeth, the nation gained a new self-confidence and a sense of sovereignty as Christendom fragmented. Because, you had all these Protestant rebellions that were going on everywhere else. She was the first Tudor to recognise that a monarch ruled by popular consent. And she therefore always worked with Parliament and advisers she could trust to tell her the truth, a style of government that her Stuart successors failed to follow. Some historians have called her lucky, but she believed that it was God who was protecting her. Priding herself on being mere English, Elizabeth trusted in God, honest advice, and the love of her subjects for the success of her rule. In a prayer, she offered thanks to God that, at a time when wars and seditions with grievous persecutions have vexed almost all kings and countries around about me, my reign hath been peaceable, and my realm a receptacle to thy afflicted church. The love of my people hath appeared firm, and the devices of my enemies frustrated. And this is such a different time, isn't it, when the people actually loved their leader, and the leader knew that they would be nothing without the love of their people. And it's just the opposite, the way that it is today. I mean, our leaders seem to be trying to do what they can for foreign forces, basically, you could say. But if they're working for the banks, they're working for globalism, trying to advance the needs of the international community rather than the people here. And and the people of the country despise the politicians and despise the leaders. Whereas back then it was a reciprocal relationship. She understood that she would be nothing without without the English, and they obviously thought very highly of her. Have you got any final thoughts on Elizabeth I, Max?
No, I thoroughly agree actually with what you said there. I think she is one of the great monarchs of Britain and the English over the millennia, and it's quite right, I think, that she should be remembered in the way that she has been, as good Queen Bess, and for the things that she did, as far as defending Britain against the Spanish Armada, etc. And we spoke about nationalism earlier, and I think it's quite clear that she was a nationalist queen, and that's reflected in the way that she ruled Britain, and also in the appreciation of that benevolent rule that the British people showed her.
She saw herself as being the head of the family, and rather than it being the father, it was the mother, and that's why she never married. She saw herself as being married to the nation and being the head of that nation, and she took that very seriously. And yeah, she definitely deserves to be in our greatest Britons. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I believe it will be a Radio Albion Roundtable next week, so we will be back with more Real Britannia in the future. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.